Once upon a time, fashion was defined by elite European designers. Today, we, the consumers, call the shots. In this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, we look into the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. Our guest is journalist Terry Agins. She covers the fashion beat for the Wall Street Journal. She is the author of The End of Fashion, The Mass Marketing of the Clothing Business. The book covers every aspect of the business, and it features profiles of key players in the industry. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Terry Agins is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. She's covered the fashion business for the newspaper for 10 years. Her book, The End of Fashion, The Mass Marketing of the Clothing Business, is published by William Morrow. Again, our telephone numbers, 333-WILL and toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. Terry Agins, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us
today. Yeah, thanks for having me.
When did designers begin to lose their ability to dictate what we wear?
Well, you know, it had a lot to do with just the way that retailing changed in the United States. I mean, we think of when the whole malling of America started in the 70s, and we had all these different retailers who started to come up with their own looks. I mean, the Limited and stores like the Gap really had a lot to do with kind of changing the way people saw fashion. These retailers did not look to Paris to decide what they were going to market, but they really looked to see what people were buying and, you know, talking to consumers and doing focus groups and finding out what people wanted to wear. And that had a lot to do with the change.
The customer is always right.
Yes, indeed.
You note four mega trends that, quoting you, sent fashion rolling in a new direction. Women let go of fashion, number one. Would you talk with us about
that
trend?
Yes. Well, the funny thing is that, of course, you know, for so many years, women were really, you know, women got credit for being elegant and being beautiful, and that was really a key part of women's self-worth. But as women started to move up in the workplace in the 70s and the 80s, women really had a lot more to worry about besides how they looked. Women always wanted to look great, but they certainly had something else to think about in terms of clothes. They wanted clothes that were functional, that really satisfied their needs as working women. And women just, I mean, you think of the couture clothes in Paris, I mean, you have to go to two or three sittings. And, you know, it requires, I mean, it's a career just trying to get dressed. And most women just don't have that kind of time. People want things that are packable. I mean, that's why a company like St. John Knits does really well, because it's something that you can wear on a plane and get off and look great. And so once women decided that they were kind of independent, that we didn't really need to follow these fashion trends, it really changed the whole business incredibly.
Yeah. And we've also stopped dressing up.
Well, this is the other thing, that we look how casual things have gotten. And, you know, curiously enough, this started with men. I went to Alcoa, the aluminum company that is based in Pittsburgh in 1991. And when Alcoa changed its dress code, they did it during a United Way campaign to try to get employees to contribute. And after a two-week kind of a test drive with letting the employees dress casually if you contributed to the campaign, Alcoa just threw out the dress code altogether. And, you know, men, of course, we look over it in Silicon Valley, and you see what's happened with the whole the information age, all the techno geeks, the internet set, as they're called, and everyone's very casual. And so men really led the charge to people getting very, very casual. And as people became more casual, they bought clothes that were much more simple and much more inexpensive.
Yeah, because nerds are in.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the richest man in the world, Bill Gates, goes to work in chinos and a sport shirt.
Also, this is really fascinating to think about. Top designers just stopped taking risks, stopped gambling on fashion, as you say, because they were going out of business.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, too, is remember, fashion is a multi-billion-dollar business, and many of the fashion companies since the time that I've been covering this industry at the Journal have become public companies like Tommy Hilfiger Corporation and Polo and Donna Karen mm-hmm. and many others. And once these companies hit that, you know, $500 million and over sales volume, they cannot afford to gamble on fashion. They have to come out with predictable clothes that they know are going to sell. They can't take a lot of risks. And naturally, they tend to go the usual, I mean, they take the path of least resistance, and they go more and more with clothes that are basic and not really that experimental in terms of fashion.
Yeah. Well, you know, this puzzles me because, you know, no matter what mall you go into now, today,
yes.
the stores and the goods are all the same. And I wonder if we could be headed toward a time when we'll see an end to the shop till you drop culture, because it's really not very interesting.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is also part of the commoditization of fashion. As we've gotten all these shops in the malls and retailers like Saks have 50 stores or so, it's impossible for the buyers to go to each one of these branches and pick and, you know, select certain clothes for that particular consumer. And so everything has gotten homogenized, and everyone goes to the lowest common denominator. So what you see is the same sea of clothes, of the cashmere sweaters, the twin sets, you know, khakis and cargo pants, etc. There are a few small boutiques who are starting to try to buck this trend, but it's really hard because most people shop according to price, and you get to sell fashion at really affordable prices when you have volume. And so that is why it's really, really hard for these little boutiques to compete, although there is some backlash because a lot of people don't want to look the same.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. An interesting story to think about, the financial difficulties faced by Filene's Basement and TJ Maxx recently.
Yeah.
It's harder for these stores to get great bargains because the good stuff is no longer trickling down.
Well, that's true. And also, too, is these designers, I remember, you know, I was a big Lohmann shopper, and you know, those shops really were the only place where some of the big designers like Donna Karan and Anne Klein could really get rid of a lot of the extra goods they have. Well, now all the designers have their own outlet stores. So there's very little, you know, additional merchandise that can be sent to these stores. And there's just so much merchandise in the pipeline. I mean, it's incredible. And when you look at stores like Walmart now sells fashion, so does Kmart, so does Target.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all this competition and, you know, with prices going lower and lower and lower. And so it's really hard for a TJ Maxx to come out with something that's really unusual, and it's a bargain because you can get bargains everywhere.
Yeah. Does anybody pay full price anymore?
Well, no one pays full price, and that's the other thing that is really, when I talk about the end of fashion, I talk about the end of fashion as we knew it. And in the past, you know, sales were a very orderly, you know, clearance sales came at the end of each season. And it was just what was left over. And you looked forward to that sale, and you went out and shopped. But now everything has to be on sale all the time because there's all this merchandise in the pipeline, and the way to keep that merchandise moving is to mark it down. And most shoppers, I mean, if you look at studies will tell you that most shoppers are motivated to buy by price. And there's also a psychological thing about catching something on sale, even though it is a kind of a pseudo sale sometimes.
Yeah. Now, something I don't remember ever seeing when I was growing up was coupons for department stores.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is something else. It's another gimmick. All these are the funny thing is that here we are in this incredible stretch of economic prosperity, and you would think that people would want to shop, and shop a lot and spend a lot. But because there is so much merchandise in the pipeline, the retailers have to get rid of this merchandise, and they do it by with these coupons. So it's another gimmick to keep people shopping. And shoppers have gotten so savvy about buying at full price that people wait, and they wait for the double coupon, and you get a special coupon. You know, you get an additional discount if you sign up for an in-store charge card. And, you know, it just becomes, it really does undermine the whole notion of full price.
Yeah. How do you think that consumers will, we might one of these days buck these trends?
Well, it's hard to say, because now, as I said, fashion is now everybody's game. Fashion used to be an elite game that was played by, you know, department stores and some specialty stores, but now you can buy fashion everywhere. And as a result, it's going to be really hard to break this cycle. Most shoppers are accustomed to buying clothes at lower prices. They're accustomed to having a lot of selection and also, you know, fairly high quality. I mean, you'd be surprised some of the things that come out of Kmart and Target. The quality is not that much different from the quality at some of the department stores. So, you know, it's going to be hard to break. Well, it's going to be impossible to break this cycle. You know, fashion is a global business. It's moving very, very fast. And most shoppers consider clothes really kind of disposable. So they don't want to invest for inexpensive clothes when they're going to get rid of them the next year.
Yeah. Here's something interesting to think about that you write about in The End of Fashion. The ads that the mass market mega designers produce, the businesses like Hilfiger, Lauren, Claiborne, Klein, those ads are, you write, more arresting than any fashion spread featuring their clothes in the editorial pages of the fashion magazines.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that where designers have really, really missed the boat. I mean, you look in the magazines like, you know, the Vogues and Harper's Bazaars, and you know, it's usually, you know, it's still an elitist dream. A lot of the photographs, I mean, it's all about photography and, you know, and still, you know, models and you know, exotic locations. And I think most consumers are just kind of jaded. People want to look at a magazine, pick up a fashion magazine, and see clothes that they can buy. They want to see prices. They want to see the clothes in focus. And that's why the designers that you just mentioned do such a great job at being able to, you know, come up with an image. I mean, Tommy Hilfiger has that flag, those kids smiling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very Americana. And it really connects with people immediately. And then in some of the other ads, you actually see the clothes. You look at a magazine like Marie Claire, for example, and Marie Claire shows the clothes almost like a catalog. A lot of times there aren't even models in the clothes. The clothes are just out there, and you see the different prices, and you see the clothes in focus. But the fashion magazines have really failed. The traditional magazines have failed because they have still presented fashion as a fantasy. When most shoppers want to see something that is, you know, that they can relate to, that's not hard to understand, that's not esoteric, that's not elitist, but just something that really does connect with them. And that's why Gap and, you know, Hilfiger and Polo and some of the other companies have done such a terrific job. And you hear people say when they read the magazines that they love to look at those ads.
Yeah. Have the ranks of the fashion press thinned recently?
Have the ranks? Well, the fashion press, it's interesting because you're starting, I mean, a lot of the magazines, the publications are not doing the big fashion takeouts that they used to do. They still will show runway pictures. I mean, USA Today, for example, is not doing the heavy-duty coverage that they used to do in the past. And I have a little of this in the book, and it was because a reporter who was covering the collections at that time in 95 said that, you know, it just didn't make sense because the readers didn't want to read that type of fashion coverage. We're seeing most of the coverage we see now, there's a lot of celebrity coverage. And celebrities are really the one way to connect with consumers because most people like to look at them more than supermodels. And that's why a magazine like In Style really does connect with people because you see Demi Moore or, you know, Lauryn Hill or whoever, and you see them at parties or you know, out on the town or in their homes. And you know, a lot of readers like to read that. But it really just goes to show you how difficult it is to really break through the clutter for, you know, some fashion brand to really find a way to, like, get people to look up.
Yeah. Well, thinking now of we're buying magazines, we're buying fashion magazines for the ads. We're also willing to plunk down money for clothing that's an advertisement for the mega mass marketers.
Yes.
Labels on the inside aren't enough anymore.
Those logos.
Yeah.
Well, you look what's happened with accessories, for example. The one thing that's selling that's really interesting are expensive accessories. If you ever watch that show, Sex and the City, Sarah Jessica Parker carries the Fendi Baguette handbag, which is a bag that sells for average price about $1,100, and it goes much higher in certain versions. And that bag has really taken off. It's got a big logo. People can see it. You can see it a mile away. And women wear those with casual clothes. I mean, they'll buy two or three of these bags from Gucci and Fendi and Prada. And people will spend money on accessories, on shoes, too, instead of buying expensive clothes. So it just shows how the industry is really, really trying to sort itself out to try to figure out how do you really get people interested in fashion. People are interested in accessories because I guess they believe that they last longer and they're more versatile, but they're not buying expensive clothes the way they used to.
Mm. You quote the founder of Def Jam Records in the book, Russell Simmons, as offering a really powerful insight into this phenomenon. He says, we want to buy into the stuff we see on television, but we want to put our own twist on it. Part of the fantasy of fashion is about being successful. I want to buy into this culture.
Exactly. Yeah, well, what Russell was referring to is that he was talking about the whole hip-hop, the notion of why all the hip-hop kids like the big logos. And, you know, and this is all part of, especially young people, have always been interested in wearing something that is identifiable, that people can see. And, you know, you've got a whole generation of young people who have grown up not really knowing the hallmarks of fine clothes. They don't know about bound buttonholes and French seams, but they do know about logos, and they do know about MTV. And, you know, these are the types of images that make more sense to them than really some, fashion fantasy, because it's something that you can show off, that people can see, and it shows that you're successful, and it shows that you belong to a certain crowd. So it's really interesting how, you know, this really plays into the mind of consumers. That's why advertising is such a big deal.
Yeah, and if you see somebody like Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, well, Snoop was he happened to wear, and this is really interesting, Tommy Hilfiger's brother used to be a concert promoter, and Andy would always take bags of clothes for people to wear, because he figured if he passed them out to some of the different artists that somebody would wear them. And so he passes out this sweater, this rugby shirt, Tommy Hilfiger logo with Tommy on the front and Hilfiger on the back, to Snoop when he's in town and in New York. And Snoop happens to wear it on Saturday Night Live. And I think that was 94. And when he wore that shirt, they said the next Monday, you know, the phone lines lit up because, you know, all the stylists and consumers, everybody wanted to get their hands on that shirt.
Yeah.
And it really did, because, you know, Snoop had all this, you know, hip street credibility. And because he chose to wear that shirt, and it was totally just luck, because Andy said he had no idea that he was going to wear the shirt. But it really, really did connect with a lot of people. And then a lot of the rappers started wearing, Tommy's clothes, and they liked the big logos. And that played into that whole aspirational, trend that we were talking about earlier. And, you know, it really did help burnish that label and gave it a real hip edge.
Yeah. It's kind of ironic, isn't it, though, too, that Tommy Hilfiger, who's a sort of, his stuff is kind of, you know, it's the models are healthy and clean cut, and he's at once he's a departure from Ralph Lauren, who's pretty preppy-ish, and and the, you know, too sexy for my shirt, Calvin Klein. These urban kids are wearing Hilfiger.
Yeah, well, Tommy was very, that the Tommy Hilfiger Corporation, which is also a New York Stock Exchange company, and coincidentally the same size as Polo Ralph Lauren, sales is about $1.6 billion annually. This is a company that really, really has figured out this whole, the whole confluence of pop culture and advertising and music, and also then just basic American fashion. And, you know, a lot of the fashionistas you know, the elite fashion snobs all think that, oh, well, Tommy's not really a designer because he hasn't studied in Paris, and he really hasn't apprenticed with anyone, and he's not, you know, a guy who's making couture gowns. But, you know, today's fashion is now about American sportswear. I mean, Ralph Lauren was really, really instrumental in showing that the American look was not something that was just, you know, basic and knock around, but it really was very functional and modern, and he's been preaching this for years, and Tommy took this to another level too and made it something that, you know, imparted something with it that had, you know, a taste level that really connected with a lot of people. So even though the fashionistas may say that Tommy's not a real designer, I think if you would ask, you know, five consumers, they would consider him just as much a designer as, you know, Yves Saint Laurent or Valentino.
Mm. We're talking this afternoon with journalist Terry Agins about her book, The End of Fashion, The Mass Marketing of the Clothing Business. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening in Illinois or Indiana, toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. We have a caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. I was hoping that you would say something about the connection between your discussion about lowering prices in retail and the whole sweatshop phenomenon in the third world. I don't know if you addressed that in your book. I haven't read it, but could you say a few words about that?
No, I didn't address it in the book because it's kind of a different subject. I mean, the fact is that, you know, American consumers and all consumers want to the lowest price, and the reason why we don't have apparel manufacturing here in the United States the way we used to is because, you know, the unions, you know, because of union labor, kept prices high, and once companies started going offshore, you know, the prices got lower, and I think that it's, you know, it's a very complex situation, the situation of foreign apparel manufacturing, because I think most companies do want to pay people a fair wage, but a fair wage in one country is not what it is here. And, I mean, just the standards of the work standards are completely different than they are in the United States. It's a very complex topic. I didn't get into it in the book, but it is certainly a fascinating topic as we, you know, as the world becomes, you know, one big global community and, you know, everyone's worried about, concerned about human rights and fair wages. But at the same time, as I said, you know, American consumers speak with forked tongue because we still all insist that we get the lowest price. And unfortunately, you know, people are going to be exploited as, you know, in this capitalistic situation.
Well, this is what I'm wondering. You know, what we saw in Seattle, that people aren't, some people at least, aren't just standing by and watching all this happen. And I'm wondering, since you're following fashion trends, if perhaps the consumers, since they have led the down with the elitism fashion trend on the one hand, they might also lead the down with the third world exploitation movement on the other. It's just a comment. I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think your point is really well taken. The only thing is, as I said, I think that this is a lot harder to capture because even the honest companies who want to, you know, apparel manufacturing is not something that is done, and, you know, we're not talking about big factories. An apparel factory are five women in a room with a sewing machine, with sewing machines. And even though companies have ways to monitor a lot of this, a lot of these companies do, they use subcontractors. And it's one of these things, as I said, it's very, very hard. It's a very complex situation, and it's hard to monitor. But as you said, it's something that probably will become, you know, an issue in the future as, you know, people are concerned. But it's really interesting. You hear people talk about, you know, I don't think most people even pay attention to where the labels of where the countries, where things are made, because people are so driven by price. But, you know, it's an interesting thought.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Terry Agins. She is a journalist for The Wall Street Journal. She is the author of The End of Fashion, The Mass Marketing of the Clothing Business. Your telephone calls are welcome, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. How are department stores faring today?
Well, the department store industry, and by department stores, we mean stores like Macy's and Bloomingdale's and Burdine's and in your area like Marshall Field's. And those shops are, those stores have really had a difficult time because the discounters have really come in and stolen market share from them in terms of apparel. I mean, as you remember, department stores used to carry stereos and kitchen equipment mm-hmm. and, you know, and so many different departments, but now they're basically selling apparel and cosmetics and maybe a few, you know, sheets and towels. So department stores, they've survived because they've consolidated, and now most of the department stores are operated by companies like Federated Department Stores, May, Dillard, Nordstrom. You know, there are only a few kind of big groups left because most of them have really had to, you know, they couldn't survive to, and stay in business. Here again, the department stores also sell, you know, everyone's selling mainstream fashion because it's easier to sell at volume.
Yeah. You devote a chapter to department stores and Marshall Field's in particular. And once upon a time, even though the name Marshall Field meant, you know, upscale merchandise, mm-hmm. everybody shopped there.
Oh, yeah, but Field's was an interesting, I chose Field's to profile because it meant so much to Chicago because the Marshall Field family, really, they were great philanthropists as far as the developing the city, and people really had a connection to Fields. But what the Fields predicament, it's now owned by a company called Dayton Hudson in Minneapolis, and Fields' predicament really kind of mirrors what happened as department stores really had a harder time competing with discounters, and as, you know, retailing became everybody's game. It used to be in Chicago, for example, that you only really had, Fields had no competition. They had Carson Perry Scott and a few other local stores. But, you know, after a while, by the late 80s, Bloomingdale's was in Chicago, and so was Henri Bendel, and all these other mm-hmm. stores, not to mention the discounters. And so Fields faced much more competition than ever, and also Fields was not independently owned because it, too, had also gone through the mergers that were part of the late 80s in the department store consolidation. So Fields' situation kind of mirrors how you know, department store retailing has changed in the United States.
Let's talk with another caller on line one, this caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in what the first caller was talking about, and I was wondering if you are familiar with any focus groups that look at the issue of whether consumers are more likely to buy if they're assured that the items are not made by, you know, sweatshops in other countries. I'm thinking particularly how this worked in the cosmetic industry.
Well, as I said, I don't know. I mean, this industry also is notorious for not keeping good. This industry does not have a lot of good intelligence as far as you know, statistical information. I have that same problem when I'm doing my stories. But as I said, it's one of those. This whole sweatshop issue and made in the USA in terms of clothes is something that, as I said, people pay a lot of consumers pay a lot of lip service to. And as I said, I think a lot of people are very, there is a silent group of, or a small group of people who are very, very concerned about it. But then again, I mean, how do you monitor something like this? I mean, it's just, as I said, it's a very complex issue. How do you know what, and the companies who even purport to do the right thing and to really monitor, they are not, their people can't be all around when a contractor and you know, some Far East country decides to, you know, have some people, you know, fill an order, and he doesn't know how they're doing the keeping the factories. I mean, it's a very complex situation. But as she said, with all the uproar in Seattle, I think really let us know that people, there are more people who are concerned about this whole situation than what we think. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
Very interesting. It sounds like a matter of size, then, that maybe the industries, as many industries, are getting too large to really know what one of them is.
Yeah, they're large, they're far-flung, you know, they're contractors and subcontractors, and, you know, it's just really hard to really keep up with what exactly is happening. You know, and then the other thing is, as I said, you know, capitalism, you know, it's greed, and it's all about, you know, selling and selling for a profit and making, you know, the best return on the investment. And this has a lot to do, a lot of these companies are public. And it really, when people are under the pressure to make earnings targets and to really show growing profits every quarter, you know, a lot of things just, they happen and people don't pay attention to them.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. What's the toughest challenge you've faced as a reporter on the fashion beat for the Wall Street Journal? It's got to be a tough beat.
Yeah, well, I've been here for 15 years, and I wrote about airlines, and I also covered the courthouse for a while. And we cover this industry like we cover anything else, and we're looking at we don't look at this as art. We look at this as business and companies. And the one great way about covering something from a business aspect, you know, it either sells or it doesn't sell, it works or it doesn't work. There's not a lot of subjectivity that goes in your thinking. And I write about the manufacturing and marketing of clothes. We do not care about who does or doesn't advertise with us. So a lot of people who I interview know that's not going to make any impression on me one way or the other. And I'm looking for an interesting story and a story that will always really tell people something that they didn't know that's surprising. And so I don't write fashion show reviews. So a lot of the companies, when they hear that I'm calling, they assume that, you know, I'm going to do something that is so-called negative. And I tell them, you know, clearly that's not, you know, I don't have any agenda. We just want to tell people, give people an insight, just like I did with this book, into just the complexities in this industry, where you have all these huge, larger-than-life figures, and often a lot of them, like Isaac Mizrahi, that designer who went out of business in 1998, very popular, was on Celebrity Jeopardy, and had a wonderful movie made about him, and just an entertaining, charming guy, and a wonderful designer, but really not a very small and unprofitable business. But most people didn't know that because, you know, you don't really get that in fashion coverage. So, you know, my job is to try to really get at some of these stories, some of these true stories, some of this behind the scenes to let people know what's going on.
Yeah. Back to the phones. A caller in Urbana on line one. Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question. I'm wondering if I just recently joined the discussion in terms of listening, and I'm wondering if you have covered the movement toward buying things that have already been used, the secondhand, the frippery movement, if that you've covered in your book at all?
Well, I didn't cover it in the book, but I've certainly written about it at the Journal, and the whole vintage clothing movement is big, and also clothes sold at auction. I mean, this is something that is fairly new, and you know, some of it is, of course, if Marilyn Monroe wore a dress, then that would give the dress a certain amount of interest. But I'm talking about just couture clothes, because there's so few of these clothes now that are made the old-fashioned way, and a lot of people now want the real discriminating client who wants something that's really handmade and has a lot of workmanship. You know, these people are tending to go to the secondhand shops and also to buy clothes at the couture auctions. So that is something, but it's still a small movement and really doesn't have a lot to do with the impact of on sales, but it certainly is a trend.
Okay, thank you. Also, I'd like to know how you got your start in this particular area.
Well, you know, I believe it or not, I'm from Kansas City, and when I was 14, I wrote a fashion column for my junior high school newspaper called Terry's Tips for Fashion Flair. And this was just because I like clothes, and the journalism teacher thought it would be a great idea. But I had never dreamed that, you know, many years down the line I would be doing this. But, you know, at the Journal, we change beats every once in a while. And, you know, I'm a big shopper and like clothes and you know, wanted to cover this. And I actually kind of started this beat here at the Journal and developed it into something that, you know, would show a lot about our culture and about business and just how, you know, people change and everything. So it's been fun to write about and to accompany and to see all these, you know, startling changes happen, you know, over the last decade.
All right. Thank you very much for being there.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Has covering the fashion beat changed you as one consumer? Has it had an impact on your taste or how you select clothing?
Oh, totally. I think that, first thing is I have been exposed to every level. I've been exposed to couture houses when I was in Paris and I was doing the research for my chapter on Emmanuel Ungaro. He was a disciple of Balenciaga and the greatest couturier ever known, and I got to watch him up close work and got to look at these clothes inside out, and they're just absolutely exquisite. So once you get exposed to a lot of clothes like this, obviously you go back, you look in your closet, and the clothes that you have don't look so fine. But at the same time, I've also been exposed. This year I did a story called Cheapskate Chic about people buying clothes at places like Walmart and Kmart and bragging about it, including Blaine Trump, Donald Trump's sister-in-law, who buys some of her gardening shorts at Kmart. And she goes to the ones in Florida because they have a better color selection for $9.99. And when I was doing this story, I found a wonderful denim skirt for myself at Kmart for $14.99 that had zipped up the back and had this wonderful embroidery on it. So I've been exposed to both ends of the spectrum. And I must say, I am now certainly less fascinated about labels, and I try to shop intrinsic quality. I too am looking for a bargain, and I don't usually let labels guide me that much, except in terms of the way clothes are cut and size. If I know I wear a certain size in a particular manufacturer, I'll buy that one or look for that manufacturer. But I don't buy as much. I don't know about you, but there's no place to dress up. When I was on book leave, I didn't buy any clothes for almost 2 years, and I started going shopping in my closet, and I found some great stuff that I had forgotten about. So I think I'm buying less, and, I've developed my own style, and I wear the same type of thing and just kind of update it a little.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller on line 4 in Aurora. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. I have 3 daughters, and, of course, we have always been fashion conscious in this house, and but I don't see fashion anymore. I went to a program Wednesday night, and I looked at the people and how they were dressed, and I thought there didn't seem to me to be one person dressed with any flair.
Were they young or how?
What?
How old were they? Were they really young? Or?
Well, there was quite a group, a wide age range, because it was a kindergarten, first, second, and third grade program. So you had parents and you had grandparents.
Uh-huh.
And when I see all the blue jeans and the black jeans and the black on black and the big, bulky shoes, there's no finesse to them.
No, I agree.
It's so ugly. Why do they wear them? Because there's nothing else?
It's nothing else. But remember also, now I'm 46 years old, and so when I grew up, we still had dress codes in my high school and everything. But you've got a whole generation of kids, don't forget, who grew up wearing small, medium, and large, or extra large with those pants, and the Nikes and Reeboks. And they want to be comfortable, and they think that is fashionable. And, we think that it's cool or not, the fact is that this generation has never been exposed to these other types of clothes, so there's no reason for them to covet them.
No,
nothing to do with socioeconomic level. It's just all the kids dress like that.
Well, I'm not even talking about the kids. I'm talking about their parents and the grandparents who wear these big things to cover whatever they want covered. I guess I could be called old-fashioned.
Well, I feel that way, too. And the thing is, as a consumer, I don't like it either. But the whole fact is that that's the way the world is going. And the other thing is, too, is as I said, once people, look at all the things that women now can really take pride in, and having careers and running companies and everything. And, clothes have just become less of a priority. That's why all these guys in Silicon Valley and all the dot-com companies, what they're getting off on is not looking great, but inventing something and inventing some new, this new frontier of the Internet. And it just really, clothes have just taken a back seat in people's lives. Mm. And I think that has a lot to do with it. And people just, it's just, you know, like I said, it's the end of fashion the way we knew it.
Yeah. Does the Wall Street Journal have a dress code?
No, we don't. And it's funny, and I've been here for 15 years, and when I came here in 84, the women usually had on skirts. Now, you know, we're reporters, so we don't necessarily try to look, you know, really incredibly spiffy. I mean, most people just look very clean and neat, but, you know, people have gotten very, very sloppy here at my office. But not only here, but in the Wall Street area, there's Casual Friday every day in all the brokerage firms. You see the guys walking around in their Dockers and their kind of golf shirts. And even just on other days, people have just gotten very, very casual. And it doesn't, a suit nowadays no longer connotes authority or success. I mean, look, you've got David Geffen walking around in baseball caps. You've got Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and all these captains of industry who are dressed very, you know, casually. And so, in other words, it's almost a kind of a reverse chic that, you know, that you're so wealthy that you can afford to look like you don't care.
Yeah.
Who
well,
knows?
One of the places that we see fashion, we continue to see fashion, although sometimes it's from the sublime to the ridiculous and then back from the ridiculous to the sublime, is on Oscar night.
Exactly.
And this is something you write about in the book that's a lot of fun to read. And, you know, somebody who just takes your breath away in an Armani gown, Glenn Close, you know, when she walks up to either present an award or to accept one, she says she doesn't like to dress up. And when she is looking for something to dress up in, she wants to be comfortable.
Yeah, well, see, the masterful thing about Armani, and I have a whole chapter in this about how he really captivated celebrities. And Armani really, you know, he came out with a casual style, I remember, with the wrinkled suits, taking the lining out of suits and made the men's suits very comfortable. And he did the same thing for women's apparel. And the funny thing is that, you know, movie stars, we see them all dressed up and everything, and we think that that's the way they live because, you know, it's a whole fantasy. But when I interviewed Glenn Close for the book, the one thing she told me, she said, you know, in my regular life, she said, I am a person who's very casual. I rarely dress up. And so she said, well, so on Oscar night, I don't want to look like I'm in character. I want to look like I usually do. I want to look with my regular hairdo, not a lot of jewelry, not gobs of makeup, but I still want to look elegant. And Armani gives me that. And so she says that she loves the idea that Armani makes her look normal. And she looks like a normal person, but she just looks better than herself. And I think that's the reason why Armani has really connected, not only that he has all the, he dresses all the stars, but other shoppers have gone to and bought Armani suits and dresses and other clothes because it's a very normal, modern look. It's not too fussy, and it's attractive on most people, and it doesn't look like you try too hard. And so I think that's what Glenn Close was getting at.
Yeah.
Now, you see a lot of these other stars on Oscar night, and as you said, you see a lot of crazy outfits and get-ups, but, you know, other than getting a lot of publicity for those designers, for, you know, designers like John Galliano and Halston, et cetera, but it's not really translating into sales. In other words, people don't see someone in that dress and say, oh, God, I want to go out and buy this John Galliano dress or whoever the designer is. But Armani has really managed to do that, and a lot of it has to do with his brilliant marketing, but the whole fact that these clothes also have a very modern, normal look to them.
Hmm. Fascinating beat you have, and it's really a fun book to read. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, yeah, thanks. I could go on and on, but I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry we're out of time because we've got other callers lining up to talk with you, but we have to go because we're out of time.
Okay, great.
Terry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Terry Agins has been our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The End of Fashion, The Mass Marketing of the Clothing Business. It is published by William Morrow.